Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Phil the Seal first showed up in Delaware 6 months ago. This week, after being rescued and then rehabbed at the National Aquarium in Baltimore, he was released back into the wild.
Phil's a really large animal, so it's always kind of fun to work with a challenging case. So he was just a really interesting case and kind of fun to work with.
Our science reporter Katie Pikus has more on Phil the Seal's journey back to his natural habitat. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have a look at what the restoration of Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge has meant to the horseshoe crab population, and learn about research at the University of Delaware on how to treat chronic kidney disease. Plus, our arts playlist takes you to the Freeman stage, and we hear more from our Generation Voice Youth Media Project in Enlighten Me. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Remember Phil the Seal? The wayward harbor seal was released at Gateway National Recreation Area in New Jersey Tuesday morning, about 6 months after showing up in Delaware and following 2 months of rehabilitation after being rescued here. Delaware Public Media Science reporter Katie Pikus was there for Phil's return to the sea.
After being released from a crate, it took several minutes for Phil to reacclimate himself. But once he found his way, he wiggled towards the ocean. Soon, the audience could only see a glimpse of his head peeking out of the water as he seemed to nod goodbye to the region. Erin and Rich Lambertson live just minutes away from Gateway. They were on their daily walk with their kids when a park ranger told them about Phil.
We just wanted to watch our kids and see how they reacted, and it was just really exciting. It was exciting to see all the people here, and his story is really amazing.
Their daughter, Maddie Grace, is 2.5. She describes how Phil got from the crate to the water.
Hard to get out.
It was hard for him to get out?
Yeah.
Was it awesome to watch him go back into the water?
Yeah.
Phil first showed up in Delaware right before Christmas. He came up from the Delaware Bay, through the Murder Kill River, and stopped at the spillway at Corsi Pond. He then left that spot, crossed a busy road, and stayed in Corsi Pond. Suzanne Thurman with the Marine Education Research and Rehabilitation Institute says he was probably following food.
He had far less competition there. The feeding was easy. He had to expend far less energy because it was a small area. So it was a good overwintering holiday for him.
In April, Phil got stuck in mud, and Mare Institute volunteers rescued him. They brought him to the National Aquarium in Baltimore.
That was our Katie Pikus earlier this week at Gateway National Recreation Area in New Jersey for Phil the Seal's release back into the sea. She was joined there by Kate Schaefer, rehabilitation manager at the National Aquarium, where Phil went to rehabilitate. And Katie talked to her in greater detail about what it was like getting Phil back on his flippers.
You, first of all, talk about the shape that Phil was in when he was rescued and brought to the National Aquarium.
Yeah, when Phil was first brought in, his overall body condition was okay, but he was suffering from a pretty severe eye infection, and he was dehydrated. So we started right away in rehydrating him, giving him fluids, and treating that eye infection to help him on the road to recovery.
And so what was done on a daily basis to rehabilitate him and get him back into better shape?
Yeah, so when he first came in, he was getting fluids every day to help hydrate him. He was also getting daily eye medications and placed on oral antibiotics as well that he was given in his food that helped combat that eye infection as well as some internal viral infections that we thought he was suffering from as well.
The phrase neurological condition has been used before with Phil. Can you talk about what kind of condition that was?
Phil had a small seizure-like episode at one point during his rehabilitation, but it was a single episode, and he was monitored very carefully after that, and no additional signs were seen of that. We think it possibly could have been a reaction of his body to the different infections that were going on.
And what was treating Phil like? How did he respond in comparison to other seals that you guys have had?
Yeah, so Phil's a little larger than our average seal patient, so he kind of provided us with some interesting challenges, and a few of the times because of his size and because of the procedures that we needed to do, we actually had to sedate him and put him under anesthesia, which can be a little risky with these guys, so we were very happy that he responded well to those treatments.
And Phil came in a certain way, and he gained some pounds. Can you talk about his transformation, I guess?
He started eating pretty early on in rehab, and we were able to increase his calorie intake to try to pack the pounds on him. I believe he came in at about 55 kgs, which is about 120 pounds. And he, this morning, weighed in at 76 kgs, so he gained 20 kilograms while he was with us, which is a pretty sizable amount.
So how did the National Aquarium know when Phil was ready to go?
So we base a lot of their health assessments on their blood results as well as their overall physical condition. So once they're acting normally, eating normally, their blood values are within normal range, then our vet team will make that call and determine that they're ready to be returned to the wild.
And once you guys made the call, you had to apply for release with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration?
That's right. Any work involving marine mammals is regulated by NOAA, and so they give us permission to do the work that we do. We do it under a NOAA permit, and so we have to get their permission to put an animal back into the wild.
So was that like a difficult process, or what was that process like?
No, it's just basically providing NOAA with a health assessment of the animal and overall summary of the case and what happened with the animal while they were in rehab, what they were treated for, and why we believe the animal is ready to go back.
And Kate, talk about where we are now and how this location was decided.
So Phil was an out-of-habitat animal when he stranded, and so we wanted to release him at a location north of the Delaware Bay to try and prevent him going back out of habitat again and into an area that wasn't suitable for him to thrive. And so we brought him here to New Jersey to give him access kind of to the open ocean where he hopefully won't return to the Delaware Bay.
As you were saying, he was an out-of-habitat animal, so you don't want the same situation that happened to Phil in the winter to happen again.
Exactly. So Phil ended up about 12 miles upstream in Kersey's Pond in Delaware. Basically, it's not a suitable habitat for seals. He survived there for quite a while, was being monitored, but eventually started showing signs of declining health.
Anna, in Phil's case, which you just described, being an out-of-habitat animal, how frequently do you guys get cases like that?
It's pretty unusual. I don't know that the National Aquarium has ever had an out-of-habitat seal that we've treated in our rehab before.
And Phil, as the out-of-habitat seal, marks what number release for the National Aquarium?
Phil is our 200th release of a rehabilitated animal for the National Aquarium.
Are we seeing more situations, you know, animals getting off course and stranded regionally from New Jersey to Maryland? Or, you know, if we are, why is that?
I don't really know the answer to that question. I'm not sure if we're seeing an increase. You know, we are only responsible usually for our Maryland habitat, so, you know, that would take a comparison with Delaware and New Jersey's animals, which I don't have that information.
Gotcha. And what was some of the most exciting things for you about working with Phil?
Like I said, Phil's a really large animal, so it's always kind of fun to work with a challenging case and also to work with an animal with some ailments that you haven't necessarily been working with a lot in the past. Phil also had ticks on his body during rehab, so we identified those. We tested for tick-borne disease to make sure he wasn't suffering from anything in that realm. So he was just a really interesting case and kind of fun to work with.
Again, thanks to our Katie Pikus and the National Aquarium's Kate Schaefer for their time this week talking about returning Phil the seal back to his natural habitat. And we have more from Katie Pikus in the Science Desk next. She'll tell us about one example of how the restoration of Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge is already paying dividends. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. In 2012, Hurricane Sandy blew through Fowler Beach at Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge, tearing it apart. By October 2016, most of a federal restoration project restoring 4,000 acres of that refuge was complete, repairing 25 miles of tidal channels and the damaged shoreline, making them more resilient against future storms. And one of the other benefits of a restored beach? A treasure trove of horseshoe crabs, as far as the eye can see. Delaware Public Media Science reporter returns to tell us more about it.
It's the eve of the summer solstice, the longest day of the year, when Laura Mitchell, Dan Stotts, and their two boys, Ian and Travis, are walking along Fowler Beach. They're counting the horseshoe crabs on a 1,000-meter stretch of restored sand.
Two males, one female.
They walk 20 meters. Then they lay a white square called a quadrat down on the sand. They record how many horseshoe crabs are in or near the perimeter. Then they repeat until they hit 1,000 meters.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 males. 17 males, 2 females.
2 females, 17 males. Thank you, Ian.
Tonight, Laura and Dan counted 131 crabs as part of their sample. That number will help scientists estimate whole populations and track changes in the species' numbers over time. Laura Mitchell says here at Fowler Beach, that data is more than just numbers on a ledger.
This is something that's important for Delaware Bay, it's important for the estuary, it's important for the shorebirds, and we want to show that, you know, we've had an drastic increase in the populations.
Dan Stotz says if they're lucky enough, they'll see some shorebirds like red knots that feed on horseshoe crab eggs. They see a small oyster catcher dart across the sand.
Oyster catcher.
And dozens of gulls. Laura and Dan both work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The federal agency received $38 million in funding to restore 4,000 acres of the refuge to withstand storm damage.
This was not here a year ago. None of this was here. You know, this is material that came from an offshore dredge area that they calculated very carefully and had enough material to basically recreate this beach. So we're walking on something that was under Delaware Bay a year ago.
Restoration crews finished repairing the back barrier of the beach in the dune in 2015, infusing the new beach with 1.4 million cubic yards of coarse sand. The tidal channels were finished in June 2016. Al Rizzo led the restoration project for U.S. Fish and Wildlife. He says research from the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control pointed to horseshoe crabs spawning better on coarse grains. Before the restoration, the refuge had fine sand, which is more erodible, as seen in when Hurricane Sandy and subsequent storms hit.
When the beach was gone and actually blown out, actually created flood shoals. So we didn't have a contiguous beach anymore. We had little remnants of the beach. The crabs would get sucked into the impoundments in the incoming tide and get trapped.
Rizzo says after that damage was done, they weren't seeing the number of horseshoe crabs they historically had seen. Now, with Fowler Beach restored, plenty of horseshoe crabs are spawning, and there are plenty of eggs. That increases the possibility that red knots will show up here. The shorebird has been considered threatened under the Endangered Species Act.
We hope to see red knots, but you know, ruddy turnstones, sanderlings, other shorebird utilize the eggs. But one ancillary benefit that we're starting to see is now that we have piping plovers that are threatened on the federal and threatened list, that the gulls are actually feeding on the horseshoe crabs that get stranded. So it kind of lures them away from the actual predation of the chicks.
So the returning horseshoe crabs have a key role to play, a role Travis and Ian Stotz described on the drive home from the spawning survey.
Partly, the horseshoe crabs are part of the ecosystem, and without part of the ecosystem, it all collapses. And also, the horseshoe crabs have been around here for a long time, 300 million years, and if they weren't here, then more problems than you would expect would probably show up.
It's like a domino effect. One creature goes out, the creatures that depend upon it go out.
And with a restored Fowler Beach in place, it appears that the ecosystem can again count on the creature that outlived the dinosaurs to do its part. Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie. And you can see pictures from Katie's trip to count horseshoe crabs on Fowler Beach online right now at DelawarePublic.org. And there's more to come on this week's edition of The Green, including a look at the Freeman Stage in Selbyville and what it has to offer this summer. But first, a check of your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Freeman Stage at Bayside, just west of Fenwick Island, is celebrating its 10th season this summer. The venue has become a live music staple in Sussex County over the past decade. And in our latest arts playlist, our Mark Earhart spoke with communications manager Allison Cunningham about where the Freeman Stage started and where it's headed.
Allison Cunningham, thanks for joining us. This marks the 10-year anniversary for the Freeman Stage. How did the venue start a decade ago? What did it look like?
The Freeman Stage at Bayside, its first season was in 2008. So our founder, Michelle Freeman, the wife of Josh Freeman, who the foundation is named after, you know, asked our executive director, you know, what she thought about the possibility of creating this community stage where performances could happen and what she thought that might look like. And so in the spring of 2008, the Freeman Stage debuted, and it was what it was for the last 9 years, a small wooden stage, pavilion-like or gazebo-like, where we had everything from national recording artists to tribute bands to local musicians come and perform on that stage. And that first season, we had 13,500 patrons visit the Freeman Stage that year. And then accelerate to the 9 years later, later, and in our ninth season, we had over 62,000 patrons visit the stage. And this year, we have a different stage at the venue. It's a larger, more industry standard stage. We tore down the old wooden stage last fall, and the feel of the venue is a little different this year, but what people can expect definitely has stayed the same. It's inviting, you know, it's for everybody. We hope that parents can bring their kids and grandparents, and but really, you know, the looks might have changed. Who you might see on stage might be a little different, but the magic we think that happens on that little slice of heaven, as we like to call it, is still there.
So you tore down the old wooden stage, the original mm-hmm. stage. Was that kind of bittersweet?
Absolutely. When the stage was first conceived as an idea and put into motion, I don't think any of us could have imagined sort of where we've come, you know, how far we've come, and, you know, how big of a impact we have on the community and how much people love and enjoy it. So it was a little bittersweet to see the little wooden stage get torn down. But this is, you know, a little step into what the future might hold for us as an organization. So it was exciting all the same as well.
What does the next 10 years look like for the Freeman stage, if you can look that far?
Yeah, I think, you know, we are in the process of, we do have a future plan for, as an organization, and that would be the Coastal Arts Pavilion at Freeman Park, which is a different venue, but still offering the same experience for patrons in the community. It would be an outside venue still. It would still be located in the Bayside community. And one thing we deal with the most is just a lack of space. We're a very small piece of land. And so the next iteration of the Freeman stage at Bayside would be Coastal Arts Pavilion at Freeman Park. And we're excited, you know, for that future.
And is there a timeline on that move?
Not at this time. We're still really conceptual at this point, but we do hope to launch a capital campaign this fall. It could be a 5 to 6 year project, but it's not definite just as yet.
So that will allow you to hold more people, maybe bring in bigger bands.
Conceptually, it's about a 4,000 seat venue, which is a little bit less than double the amount of people we can hold now. So absolutely being able to bring more people in, being able to seat more people does offer the potential to bring in larger acts.
So obviously in Delaware, Newcastle County gets big name bands and, you know, medium name bands as well. And then you have Firefly in Kent County, which can bring in some of the most well-known musicians, even worldwide, Paul McCartney, Bob Dylan, bands like that. And in Sussex County, it's been kind of hit or miss, right, in terms of being able to attract big name bands. But the Freeman stage is kind of held in there. What's made it work?
You know, I think Michelle Freeman, our founder and president, her thought was that this was Sussex County, and this little, and Southern Delaware was an arts desert, so to speak, where the opportunity to see arts performances, to see whether that's, you know, plays, musicals, or musicians. We didn't really have that here, and, you know, we would have to travel to more metropolitan areas, whether that's Northern Delaware or, you know, even Philly and Washington, D.C. So I think that one of the reasons we've maybe been able to excel, so to speak, is that people in this area crave that. They pack the kids up after dinner and come down and see a great performance. And I think that's really why our patrons have continued to say, yes, this is what we want.
So looking at your summer lineup, it seems like the stage wants to appeal to fans of maybe even the last 50 years of music. You've got a mm-hmm. band coming in, the OJs, who had that song Love Train. There's also 90s favorites like the Wallflowers and even Blues Traveler, and a band that's close to my heart, Trombone Shorty, a modern New Orleans jazz artist, is coming later this summer. Does the Freeman stage have a certain kind of act you try to book? It seems like all these acts are vastly different.
Yeah, that's part of our mission, is partnering to present memorable arts performances and inspired arts education for all. And for all is not just who we're offering it to, but who we're bringing in for them to see. We want to make sure that we have unique and diverse arts experience for people to experience. And it's not just country. It's not just classical. We are offering a wide variety of musicians. we've always, I think, been pretty diverse, but I love the fact that this season's schedule really is, hits a lot of gamuts that maybe we didn't in the past, and we're asking them to take a chance, maybe. You might not have heard of Trombone Shorty before, but we can guarantee you that it might be one of your favorite performances of the summer. So,
are there any local acts or regional acts that are hitting the stage?
We do have two locals under the lights night. This season, where local acts or up-and-coming artists are able to submit an application to be one of four acts that perform on the same stage as Tedeschi Trucks Band and Blues Traveler. And so those performances are July 27th and August 10th.
Is there an act this summer that you're most excited about?
I'm really excited for it all, obviously. I think personally, maybe because of some nostalgia, Blues Traveler, I'm really looking forward to. Definitely somebody I remember listening to growing up, so I'm excited for that one.
I can just hear it now, that harmonica, and just
yeah.
Go into town.
Exactly. So,
Allison Cunningham, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It was great.
And our thanks to Mark Earhart and the Freeman Stage, Allison Cunningham, for their time this week. For a list of upcoming bands playing at the Freeman Stage, you can head to our website, DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We'll learn about promising work being done by one University of Delaware researcher and his team on chronic kidney disease. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. And I'm Tom Byrne. A team of researchers at the University of Delaware are studying the ability to treat chronic kidney disease with exercise. Their initial findings have been encouraging, and the team has recently received a grant from the National Institutes of Health to help further that research. Delaware Public Media's James Morrison caught up with UD Professor of Kinesiology and Physiology Dave Edwards this week to learn more about his team's findings.
Just to begin, I was hoping that you'd be able to just tell me a little bit about chronic kidney disease, what it is, and then what led you to focus on using exercise to help treat this.
So chronic kidney disease is, as the name sounds, is a chronic condition where the functioning of the kidneys has declined. And stages are used to describe it, so early stages where there's some injury to the kidney but maybe function is preserved, all the way through end-stage renal disease where someone may be on dialysis and need a kidney transplant. So about 14% of the population have chronic kidney disease of some sort. And an interesting part of kidney disease is that these folks are also at very high risk for cardiovascular disease over and above what you would predict from traditional risk factors. And we've long known that exercise is beneficial in reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease. And there's standard programs for cardiac rehabilitation, pulmonary rehabilitation, and so forth. And there is some evidence that exercise is beneficial in kidney disease, but there's not quite that push in the clinical practice to prescribe exercise on a routine basis. So we've been using exercise to improve cardiovascular function, but we've kind of grown this into more of a renal rehabilitation program that kind of takes all comers at the present time.
And I did see that you're looking specifically at how exercise can improve the health of blood vessels. And I was hoping you'd be able to just explain a little bit about how exercise does help improve the health of these blood vessels and then therefore kind of trickle down to helping people that have chronic kidney disease and maybe other illnesses as well.
Yeah, so my lab's interest is in vascular function or blood vessel function. And we know that our blood vessels have a one-cell lining called the endothelium, which is very important in maintaining vascular health or vascular homeostasis. And then when that becomes dysfunctional, it sets the stage for the development of atherosclerosis and so forth. Exercise, the beneficial part of exercise is that when you exercise, it increases the blood flow through tissues and blood flow through those vessels. And that increase in blood flow causes some important vascular adaptations that can help that endothelium become more functional or better, and that we think results in a reduction in cardiovascular risk.
And what are the types of patients that should be doing exercise for treatment or that you would prescribe this to? Because you may think of, or if you don't know anyone with chronic kidney disease, you may think that that may stop someone from doing exercise. So who is able to do the exercise to help improve their condition?
Yeah, so, you know, we have folks from earlier stages, so kind of moderate kidney disease, and we do actually have some folks that are on hemodialysis that come in, and we also have some folks that are post-transplant. So all of them can exercise, but it's a matter of personalizing that exercise for the ability of that individual person. So we do that. You know, we try to get everybody to do a set amount of exercise, but the intensity is going to be different depending on what someone's coming in, their starting point would be.
And I was curious about that. So what is the amount of exercise? I know that you just said that it kind of varies from person to person, but how much do you need to get the benefits? Is it maybe 20 minutes or longer, or is it even just a few minutes?
Well, you know, the typical recommendations for kind of cardiovascular exercise or aerobic exercise is something that's at a moderate intensity for 30 minutes. And, you know, most of the guidelines are on most, if not all, days per week. So the goal is really to kind of have people come in, do some exercise with us and get confident so that they can also do some exercise on their own. So really the goal is for folks to be able to do 30 minutes of kind of aerobic or cardiovascular exercise most days of the week. So that could be going for a walk, those types of things. So some of the kind of normal kind of physical activity type things that people do count as exercise, and maybe they don't think about that. It's not that you have to go to a gym and do it on a treadmill. Going for a walk with your neighbor counts as well.
And I was reading this write-up by the University of Delaware, and it was kind of explaining how this has been really popular with patients. Can you tell me a little bit about how people who have chronic kidney disease have been responding to this idea of using exercise to kind of help improve their condition?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a team of folks that usually cares for a patient with kidney disease, includes a nephrologist, nurses, dietitian, and so forth. But kind of that, and exercise is something that's is recommended in some of the guidelines, but I'm not so sure that it gets passed down to the patients or they don't necessarily feel confident doing it. But they've responded well. They like to come to the university. They get to interact with undergraduate students and graduate students, so it's a kind of a fun environment for them and other patients. And then they start to see the benefits of being able to improve their exercise capacity, which translates into, you know, being able to do more at home. We have some folks who say, yeah, I can walk with my neighbor now, where before I couldn't keep up with them. So those are some of the examples that we see. So we kind of call that improvement in quality of life. And there are some questionnaires that we can give folks to show that we actually documented improvement in quality of life. But that's really what the patients see, improvement in their exercise capacity, their physical functioning, and their ability to do things at home.
What are your hopes for the future of your research? Where would you like to take it? Where would you like to see it go to in the future?
Well, I think from the goal of, I mean, our group, but there's lots of groups here in the U.S. And in Europe, I would argue that they're probably a little bit further ahead of us, is trying to get exercise part of kind of routine care for these folks. Similar to if someone has a heart attack, you know that they're going to end up in cardiac rehabilitation. We know the benefits of that. So we probably need some larger studies to show the long-term benefits in reducing cardiovascular risk, and we really don't even know potentially exercise could slow the progression of kidney disease. We don't know that yet either. So I think those are some things down the road that we need to kind of show in larger studies. We'll be publishing later this year the results of our small study showing some improvements in vascular function and so forth. So we hope to add to the literature base there and kind of help to grow the importance of exercise in these patients.
Well, Professor Edwards, I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today about your research, and congratulations on the NIH grant.
Oh, thanks very much. I appreciate your time.
And our thanks to James Morrison and UD Professor Dave Edwards for their time this week looking at using exercise to treat chronic kidney disease. And we wrap up this week's edition of The Green Next with Enlighten Me and more from our Generation Voice Youth Media Project. Stay with us. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In this week's Enlighten Me, we continue highlighting work done this year by students in our Generation Voice Youth Media Project at Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District. The term sanctuary has been in the news a lot lately, often in connection to safe havens in cities or on campuses for undocumented immigrants. But a sanctuary, a place of refuge and protection, can apply to anyone, including high school students. During the stressful end of year cramming for exams and for some contemplating college and next steps, Generation Voice students were asked to write about and record sounds from their own safe places. This Week and Next, we'll let you hear what some of them had to say. First up is sophomore Chris Smith's profile of his sanctuary, his backyard.
Hello? Ah, geez, man. Yeah, sorry. Can't come in today. Yeah, I'm really busy. All right, see you later. Bye-bye. My name's Chris, and whenever I get the chance to get away from everything in my life, I like to come to my sanctuary, and that sanctuary is my yard. More specifically, it's the back one. When I moved here, the yard was a mess. Vines everywhere and barely had an ounce of grass. But that all changed when I decided to restore the yard. Even though it took time out of my busy schedule of sleeping and eating Pop-Tarts all day, you know, to plant grass seeds, clean up the vines, and to sand down the stump for me to sit on. Once I got it all prettied up, I started setting up string lights at night, and I brought a projector, and we would watch movies.
My watch stopped.
Either alone or with my girlfriend. We popped popcorn and bought candy and ended up sleeping out there some nights, to the excitement of many of the mosquitoes.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
That one night where we, we set up the movie theater outside and just looked out at the stars that weren't really there. Like, it was fun.
Along with relaxing, it also helped me write music. I wrote almost an entire album out on that old stump that overlooks the busy street and the cemetery that's adjacent to my house. At night, it brings an odd atmosphere that I've never had anywhere else. And many nights have been spent sitting outside absorbing the overabundant atmosphere it brings with it. During the day, our neighbor brings out their massive golden retriever named Harley. Over the past couple years, Harley and I have grown closer, and she knows to always wait at the gate at exactly 3:01 every day for when I get home from school, to give her pets and snacks. Personally, I think she's just in it for the milk bones. Many days, I just lay around the yard, listening to the speakers I installed in the stairs, and just relaxing. It's me and my girlfriend's hangout spot, because she's obsessed with nature, and I love my yard. So it's a good combination, and it's also filled with dandelions, so she likes to sit there and make flower crowns, and she always makes me wear them at the end. My yard is my stage, my hangout, and my therapist's office. I spend what some would argue too much time out there, but I wouldn't want to spend my time anywhere else.
Thanks, Chris. Now, not all students choose a physical place to call their sanctuary and source of protection. For junior Ariel Upshur DeFranco, her older brother is her sanctuary.
A sanctuary is defined as a place of refuge or safety. Basically, a place or person you look to feel safe, secure, or both. In my case, I look to my older brother and our trips in his car. We often take trips together, just us or with our mutual friends, whether we're riding to Philly to do an event or we're riding to Rehoboth Beach in the middle of the night just to get away from it all and smell the ocean air. It's always a memory in the making when I'm with him. During our trips, we talk about anything that's on our minds or may have been on our minds since the last time we saw each other. We see each other often as we're almost inseparable, but we do have conflicting work schedules sometimes, and that may delay our next chance to be around one another.
I really don't even know what I really want to do when I get out of school. Like,
what you see yourself doing?
Like, I don't know if I want to travel or if I want to go straight to college. Like, it's just like school's so like over for me now. I don't even know what I really like want to do. And it's like before, I used to want to be in school all the time, and now it's just like I can't wait for the end of the day or whatever.
I mean, you know, school ain't for everybody, but if you go to college, you got to go look at some campuses and stuff like that. Like, I would go look if you want to go to college. Besides that,
but you know, I miss Philly so much, and it's like, I don't know if I want to go to school in Philly or if don't I want to go to school.
Stay out of Philly. Stay
so
out
why
of
would
Philly.
I stay out of Philly?
Because it's not a lot of opportunity. It's more opportunities in other places than in Philly. So you might as well, you feel me? I love Philly. That's where I'm from. That's where we're from. So it's not like, you feel me?
Due to our age difference of 2 years, he and I have different issues that may challenge us. Me still being in high school and him being graduated and out into the world. We talk for hours sometimes, with me venting to him about how I may be worrying about where I'm going to college, how I miss living in Philly sometimes, or my troubles within these school walls. He always greets my problems with open arms and always gives me good feedback on what may be troubling me that day, week, or month. The love and bond my brother and I share is unbreakable and will never be shakable. He is my rock.
Thanks, Ariel. Next up, sophomore Sean Coulter takes us into his safe place, his bedroom.
That was the sound of me sinking into my bed. And this is the sound of my PlayStation turning on. These are the sounds of my sanctuary, my bedroom. After a long day of school, I like to sit down on my bed, play some video games, and relax. A lot goes on at school.
Gotta be done.
And sometimes I just need a place to be.
It's got to be done. Cause I'm happy. I want your brain more than you. That's ridiculous.
What makes my sanctuary so nice is that I have everything I could ever want at my fingertips. Games, movies, even books. It's always nice, too, to hang out with my little sister in there, because even she can enjoy my sanctuary.
Favorite is Little Big Planet and the one with the bunnies.
That's nice. Now get out of here. Sometimes it's nice to just lie down in my room and sit on my phone, listening to all the sounds around me. Later at night, however, my room has a disadvantage. My room shares a wall with my parents' room. A very thin wall. I can hear them, and they can hear me. Oh boy, can they hear me. But I don't mind. I just throw on my headphones and continue to enjoy the many things that my room has to offer. Sometimes, however, I feel like my entire house is my sanctuary. Just being able to hang out and play games with my grandma, sister, and brother is all that I could ever ask for.
Cheers, cheers!
The sweet aroma of dinner as my grandma prepares it usually inundates the house, even being smelled all the way up in my room. I really enjoy my room as a sanctuary. It's a nice place I can get away from all the intense stress of school on any given day, and to just sit down and relax.
Thanks, Sean. Sean was one of several students to choose their bedrooms as their sanctuary. So now we'll hear how sophomore James Collins compares his to Sean's.
Recently I was asked what my sanctuary is. I've responded by saying there are many places that could be called a sanctuary because when I'm at school or at home, people around me can stress me out so much. Sometimes I just need a place to be by myself. That's Apollo and Tucker, my two dogs. Apollo's a pit bull and Tucker's a Shelton. At my house, there's chaos with dogs barking, brother screaming, parents yelling at my dogs, all kinds of stuff. Also, I live right near a major highway, so there are loud sounds from cars traveling. And when I'm at school, people are loud. They are often annoying and ignorant towards everybody. There are different groups of kids. The ones that do this the most are the popular kids. When I'm in school, all around me is drama. There is more drama in my school than there is in a chick flick. Whether it's a relationship or something else, there's just a lot of drama. So the place that I go when I get stressed is my room. My room blocks out all sound and lets me have time to myself, either in silence or with music playing. The music I listen to, some people call it depressing. It's not. My sister told me about the band Front Porch Step 2 or 3 years ago, and they're one of my favorite groups now. I usually listen to their song Drown, but it can be any song, but that's the song that I play most.
Well, I'm so tired of the rain, falling softly on the ground, just enough to get my feet wet, but not enough to let me drown.
Would you call that depressing? I don't. When I'm in my room, I don't feel any stress. I can lay down and relax without a worry. The feeling of not having to worry about anything does not come often, so when it comes, you should really embrace the feeling and treasure when it comes to you, and don't give it up. When you're stressed, you should just go back and look for that feeling, and once you get it, all the stress will go away. How I found my sanctuary is I was watching television, and my dogs were barking all at the same time. I could not ignore them, so I just went up to my room, slammed my door, and put music on my speakers. And at that point, I was happier than I have ever been before. When I'm in my sanctuary, not only do I not have to worry about anything, I feel happier than ever. It is a place of true peace and silence. It has so much more meaning to me than just a place I sleep. It's much more than that. After an hour or two of that, I am ready to face the world. Or at least Apollo and Tucker. Okay, maybe just Apollo.
Thanks, Sean. And we'll hear more student sanctuaries next week in Enlighten Me. And a reminder that all these pieces are from Generation Voice, our collaboration with the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station WMPH. Our youth media producer Megan Pauly runs that program, working with Mount Pleasant teacher Paul Wishengrad, and helped put these pieces together. And that's all we have time for on The Green this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes, as well as the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Mount Pleasant High School junior Ariel Upshore DeFranco and sophomores Chris Smith, Sean Coulter, and James Collins, all from Generation Voice, our youth media project. Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart, James Morrison, Katie Pikus, and Megan Pauly, as well as our president and station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.